Thank you, Caleb. That was an excellent introduction. And thank you, John, for the songs. I really want this to be an interactive evening. And as I went through my notes, I had a little trouble knowing how to make that happen. So I hope it happens organically, but I will just explicitly invite you to raise your hand and interrupt me if I say something that prompts something that you would like to say. Please feel free to interrupt. So if you're in a meeting or a conference or something like that, and you hear the person start talking about climate change, that term comes up, climate change, or sea level rise, or even just the term environmentalist. How does that make you feel? What is your knee-jerk response? What about some names? Greta Thunberg, Al Gore, John Kerry. What about glyphosate, GMOs, antibiotics, especially in animals? What's your knee-jerk response when those terms come up? Especially climate change. I think that's the one we probably all feel something when we hear that term. Dubious?
Activist?
Yeah. Yeah. Do you automatically question the intelligence of the person speaking? Probably shouldn't, but that's tempting sometimes. So these are concepts, people, and ideas that we tend to have strong feelings about. And if you don't, you certainly know someone who does. So my goal this evening is not to tell you if climate change is real or not, or if it's caused by humans or not. I'm not here to say whether glyphosate causes cancer or that it doesn't, or anything like that. What I really am wanting to do this evening is to shape the way we think about the world, so that as we make day-to-day decisions from the job site to the garden to our grocery trip, those of us that are farmers, we think about this a lot. I want us to leave this evening hopefully thinking a little more intentionally about it and maybe better equipped to make good decisions and to know why we make those decisions. This quote from the BioLogos website, Christian motivations to care for the natural world are clear and strong in Scripture. Yet in our culture today, environmental issues have become highly politicized so that motivations feel more political than religious. This is particularly true on the issue of climate change. In fact, studies have shown that the strongest predictor of whether we accept the scientific consensus on climate change is not how much science we know or how religious we are. It is where we fall on the political spectrum. I think we're in really bad territory if our political views are the first thing we go to on issues of science. And again, I'm not actually here to persuade or even really talk about the issues of science. There are people much better qualified than me to do that. So I try to tell myself, whenever I feel triggered by something, to step back and ask why I feel that way and to think about it. So let's take that approach. I don't think I'll say anything too triggering here this evening. There are not as many farmers here in this church as there used to be. I'd be interested, just show of hands, how many of you are actively involved in farming at this point? Yeah. There's a few, not very many. We as a church at Center, a few years ago would have been much more of us would have raised our hands there. But we farmers are faced with day-to-day decisions that maybe have a bigger impact than some of us. And so this is a topic that I'm very interested in. It's a topic that I'm glad to share on. A big debate for me right now, one that Caleb could give you an answer on and that I would mostly agree with, but might differ in some areas. The question, do we till or spray? Or ideally find a third way. And those options quickly become very complex when you look at what chemicals to use and when to use them. We're learning more and more that tilling really isn't good for the ground in a lot of ways. Pretty sure that chemical use isn't good for the ground either. And as someone who really wants to do right, it can be really frustrating to know what the best option is. I tend in my rotation to raise a lot of alfalfa, which the regenerative guys tell me I shouldn't do. But it's something that has worked for us in the past, and so it's hard to change away from that. So I want to hear from you again. I talked about some of the decisions that we farmers have to make, and it's just barely scratching the surface. Those of us who aren't farmers, what are things you think of that impact the environment around you, either positively or negatively? What are daily choices that we make? Overspray on the garden.
What we recycle and what we landfill.
Mm-hmm. Or if you live in the country, do you burn it? You said when to turn on the sprinkler or off? On? Both?
And how much to use.
And how much to use, yeah. Yeah.
Use of electricity,
yep. Use of vehicles.
How much plastic or plastic things I purchase at the store.
Mm-hmm. These are good. Keep these choices in mind as we move ahead, and you'll think of more as we go. So, as we hear about and deal with possibly triggering ideas or ideas that strike us wrong around environmentalism, climate change, whatever, I've observed several different responses that I'd like to look at, responses to those feelings that we have when the subject comes up. The first that I see as a big driver is fear. Now, we would like to think that we're not the ones motivated by fear when it comes to the environment. But Are we afraid of the people that we think are afraid? Let's think about that. I see some climate activists doing things that just seem bizarre to me. Don't make any sense. And in studying for this, I read some defenses of some of their crazy antics that, okay, I could see the point, but things like disrupting sporting events. At a Formula One race recently, there were several protesters who glued themselves to the track. Seems like a risky move. Blocking roads and runways and things like that. Disrupting traffic, trying to make a point. My favorite example was in 2022, some protesters glued themselves to the floor of the Porsche Museum in Wolfsburg, Germany. And rather than raising a fuss, the museum staff acknowledged their right to protest, and they turned out the lights and turned the heat off and left for the night. And then the protesters were very offended and very sad at how uncomfortable and cold and hungry they were, and they needed to use the bathroom. And how dare you do that to us? So I think when I see people doing things like that, I quickly say, well, I think they're people that are more afraid than they need to be. And fear makes us do funny things sometimes. Fear has been weaponized in all realms of politics. And I think especially on the subject of climate change, I should say the environment. Climate change is usually the term that we hear commonly now. But it's the environment. And fear is used to push policies that are sometimes good, sometimes terrible, sometimes good but enacted in the wrong way. There was an interesting example in 2022. California introduced a plan to ban, I believe it was to ban the sale of all gasoline-powered vehicles in the state by 2035. And then just a week later, during a heat wave, they implored residents not to charge their electric vehicles from the hours of 4 to 9 p.m. to keep from overloading the grid. So I first heard about this from a fairly conservative perspective, and you can tell how that went. That was a fun thing to jump on as proof of how ridiculous this concept is. And then it was proof of how crazy these lefties are. And that they don't understand how the world works. The progressives replied that this heat wave is proof. What more do you need? We ought to be switching to electric vehicles because this is evidence of how dire the situation is. But like I referenced before, it isn't just those people that get afraid. Sometimes we get afraid of them. And then we react in ways that are unproductive and unthoughtful, and it's too easy for us to just want to go the opposite way when we get emotional about these things. We worry that they'll push legislation or enact changes that make us uncomfortable. Most of us don't want to become uncomfortable. The truth that we need to grapple with is that sometimes the benefit of the whole requires individual choices that are unpleasant. One example would be the state of the aquifer in especially Western Kansas and on out, is that the situation is very dire. But I don't see many farmers willing to be the one farmer to turn his irrigation off. What difference is one guy turning his irrigation off going to make? And so you have this cycle where we don't want to make choices that inconvenience us because we assume they won't make a difference. And as a result, the whole collapses. So again, whatever side of the issue we're on, fear tends to cloud our vision and often moves us to make choices that clearer heads would avoid. I don't think we're particularly fearful people. I think our bigger tendency is the second response. It's kind of two lumped into one. That is apathy and or greed. I don't think any of us would think of ourselves as greedy people. But then when it comes to making day-to-day decisions, it is our tendency to look out, first of all, for ourselves. But as we hear the debate go back and forth and we hear the name-calling and the mudslinging from the political realm and from the climate activists to the climate deniers, and I kind of throw my hands up and I'm like, I don't know who to believe. I don't trust any of them. And so I'm going to just kind of do my thing and not worry too much about it. And it's easy to just check out from that conversation. Sometimes it's good to step back and avoid an emotional response and avoid the traps being laid for us there. But sometimes checking out and becoming mindless consumers, which is what can happen when we just check out, then we open ourselves up to far-reaching consequences that are undesirable. This is illustrated. This passage that I'm going to read here is almost speaks more to consumerism than the environment, but I want you to make the connection. There's a connection for sure between consumerism and the environment. This is from Wendell Berry's book, The Unsettling of America. In this passage, he is actually quoting another writer, Bernard DeVoto is the name there, someone I'm not familiar with. And he's talking about the conquest of the Native Americans by the settlers and some of the pitfalls there. I'll try to read clearly. It's a little bit heavy, so you might have to kind of work to keep up. I'll try to be clear here. The first belt knife given by a European to an Indian was a portent as great as the cloud that mushroomed over Hiroshima. Instantly, the man of 6,000 BC was bound fast to a way of life that had developed 7.5 millennia beyond his own. He began to live better, and he began to die. That phrase really stuck with me, and let's keep that in our mind. He began to live better, and he began to die. The principal European trade goods were tools, cloth, weapons, ornaments, novelties, and alcohol. The sudden availability of these things produced a revolution that affected every aspect of Indian life. The struggle for existence became easier. Immemorial handicrafts grew obsolescent, then obsolete. Methods of hunting were transformed. So were methods and the purposes of war. Standards of wealth, prestige, and honor changed. The Indians acquired commercial values and developed business cults. They became more mobile. In the sum, it was cataclysmic. A culture was forced to change much faster than change could be adjusted to. All corruptions of cultural All corruptions of culture produced breakdowns of moral, of communal integrity, and of personality, and this force was as strong as any other in the white man's subjugation of the red man. And he goes on to say how, as these changes came in so fast, and his big push in the earlier part of his book is talking about we've become disconnected from our environment to where all we need to do is find money and then we can purchase whatever we need. And we've become disconnected from the world around us in a way that is quite destructive to us. And that's where we're leaning more. Well, you could say it's greed, but I'm not sure it is. I think it's just unthinking. It's just going along with living our lives as easily as we can. In the 1940s, the world was introduced to the latest miracle on the block, DDT. It was believed to be completely safe to humans, and so large areas were blanketed with it. It's an insecticide, very effective in killing mosquitoes and other things too, but especially mosquitoes. And it was very widely used. And on the safety of DDT, I found this quote: Professor J. Gordon Edwards, an entomologist and nature-loving mountaineer, braved grizzlies and regularly ate DDT. During his many lectures, he used to swallow a tablespoon of DDT. Obviously, it's safe for everything if you can ingest it, so there's no other concerns. He enjoyed good health even at the age of 80. At 74, he scaled the Matterhorn. And a quote from him, DDT has saved more millions of lives than any other man-made chemical. So the thing with DDT is that in eradicating large populations of mosquitoes, we got rid of malaria in the U.S. And I'm generally in favor of that. I think we're all grateful that we don't struggle with malaria here anymore. But some started to observe negative consequences in the environment. Turns out blanketing a super long-lasting insecticide over tens of thousands of acres of forest, who'd have thought there might be some consequences? And a woman named Rachel Carson published a book, Silent Spring, in 1962, calling out the dangers and environmental impacts of the chemical, and in a decade later, in 72, it was banned. But there remains debate over whether it should have been or not. It might be more settled now, I'm not sure. I'm really too young to know much about it. Most of that debate was happening back in the 70s, I think. I saw a short documentary on it, and there was a character, Dr. Robert White Stevens, who had strong words for Miss Carson. He said, Miss Carson maintains that the balance of nature is a major force in the survival of man, whereas the modern scientist, the modern chemist, the modern biologist believes that man is steadily controlling nature. Does that ring true? Do you like where this is headed? Carson replied, Now to these people, the balance of nature is something that was repealed as soon as man came on the scene. Well, you might just as well assume that you could repeal the law of gravity. The balance of nature is built of a series of interrelationships between living things and between living things and their environment. You can't just step in with some brute force and change one thing without changing many others. Now, this doesn't mean, of course, that we must never interfere, that we must not attempt to tilt that balance in our favor, but unless we bring these chemicals under better control, we are certainly headed for disaster. And her campaign was effective, and like I said, a decade after that book was written, the chemical was banned. So, good thing? Bad thing? Nathan. I'm headed that direction. Yeah. Important thing to bring up. Yeah, Brian.
Maybe I missed it. Do you have more specifics on
the GPT? I ran out of time to do a deep dive on it. I do know that one thing that I read about was it was used, they blanketed tens of thousands of acres of forest with it to deal with a certain wood mite. Which, yes, it was effective, and then something else moved in that caused equal or greater damage. So, a trade-off. But, you know, miracle compound or the doom of humanity? Which is it? There's still debate about that. 'Cause here's the catch. We don't suffer from malaria in the U.S. anymore. We waited to ban the chemical until we had eradicated malaria on our own shores. Today, still over 600,000 people die of malaria every year, most of them children. Some have said that the banning of DDT is one of the greatest crimes against humanity ever committed. So which is it? Is it good or is it bad? Or was it misused? It reminds me of a saying by Thomas Sowell, "There are no solutions, only trade-offs." Caleb talked about the soil. Caleb.
Yeah, I totally agree. There's always trade-offs. The thing with malaria
is the mosquitoes are the vector for the transmission of it. The source, I believe, is stagnant pools of water. Mm-hmm. Is where the I think it's a virus originates from. So the more holistic or natural approach would be to try to build up the predator population, mm-hmm, to control the mosquitoes, because most of our problems arise from imbalances in ecosystems. Either, mm-hmm, there's not enough predators to keep the insects at bay, or there's not enough insects to feed the predators, things get out of balance.
Mm-hmm. Or we could just release swarms of genetically modified mosquitoes. Some of you know what I'm talking about. Okay, but what I'm trying to bring out here is that these are complicated issues. This is a contentious topic because it's not easy. Caleb talked about the soil, and I was so grateful for the things he said. I would have liked to go that direction and then didn't. But it's an important thing to talk about. I'm also mindful that we aren't primarily farmers here. But in the farming world, For many years, at least some, I would like to think that our grandfathers did not, but there's been a period of time where the dirt has been seen as kind of a neutral growth medium. It's there to hold the fertilizers and the seed that we put into it, and hopefully it'll hold water. Sometimes it does better than others, but it's kind of seen as a neutral, as a growth medium that's fairly neutral. More and more we're learning that it's an incredibly complex living system that needs to be cared for, that needs to be stewarded. One of the well-known speakers in the regenerative ag movement, Gabe Brown, says, "God gave us soil and we made dirt." Soil and dirt are not the same. And if you know what to look for, you can see, smell, and feel the difference between soil and dirt. So, we can spend the evening talking about the negative impacts that we humans have had and question whether our existence has been worth it, as some have done. But Nathan brought out, there's a better direction to go with this. This summer, I listened to the book, The Grapes of Wrath, by John Steinbeck. How many of you have read that? A few of you. Not good reading material for a farmer in the third year of drought. One of the most depressing books I've read in a long, long time. But excellent nonetheless. And there's a passage in that book that just, I had to listen to it over and over again, and this passage, frankly, set the direction for this topic this evening. The houses were left vacant on the land. He's talking about the sharecroppers of Oklahoma being driven off their land and needing to find other ways to make a living, a heartbreaking part of history. The houses were left vacant on the land, and the land was vacant because of this. Only the tractor sheds of corrugated iron, silver, only the tractor sheds of corrugated iron, silver and gleaming, were alive. And they were alive with metal and gasoline and oil, the discs of the plows shining. The tractors had lights shining, for there was no day and night for a tractor, and the discs turn the earth in the darkness and they glitter in the daylight. And when a horse stops work and goes into the barn, there is a life and a vitality left. There is a breathing and a warmth, and the feet shift on the straw, and the jaws champ on the hay, and the ears and the eyes are alive. There is a warmth of life in the barn, and the heat and smell of life. But when the motor of a tractor stops, it is as dead as the ore it came from. The heat goes out of it like the living heat that leaves a corpse. Then the corrugated iron doors are closed, and the tractor man drives home to town, perhaps 20 miles away, or 11, and he need not come back for weeks or months, for the tractor is dead. And this is easy and efficient, so easy that the wonder goes out of work, so efficient that the wonder goes out of land and the working of it, and with the wonder, the deep understanding and the relation. And in the tractor man, there grows the contempt that comes only to a stranger who has little understanding and no relation. This is getting lengthy, but I do need to finish this, I think. For nitrates are not the land, nor phosphates, and the length of fiber in the cotton is not the land. Carbon is not a man, nor salt, nor water, nor calcium. He is all of these, but he is much more, much more. And the land is so much more than its analysis. The man who is more than his chemistry, walking on the earth, turning his plow point for a stone, dropping his handles to slide over an outcropping, kneeling in the earth to eat his lunch. That man who is more than his elements knows the land that is more than its analysis. But the machine man, driving a dead tractor on land he does not know and love, understands only chemistry, and he is contemptuous of the land and of himself. When the corrugated iron doors are shut, he goes home, and his home is not the land. I read that, and I said, well, I'm kind of a tractor man. I even live in town. I'd like to think that I still love the land, even though I'm not farming it with living things, as Steinbeck idealizes. But it's made me thoughtful. He certainly describes a relationship with the land that I don't have. I'd like to think I have a better relationship with the land than some. Sometimes it feels pretty dysfunctional. But with this passage struck in me is the realization that what this whole question comes down to is our love. What do we love and why? So the third response is love. Genesis 1, one of the first verses any of us memorized. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness moved upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. In Genesis, we see God bringing order out of chaos, bringing light out of darkness. He took the darkness and the void, and he created life and beauty. And then man, the object of his deepest love and care, very quickly reintroduced chaos and darkness back into the land. Back into the beauty that God had so recently created. And I believe it's the duty of all of us people of the resurrection, to devote ourselves to restoring beauty and goodness and order in whatever way we can, wherever we go. When we view creation through a lens of love, it changes the choices we make. It changes the way we work and the reason we work. Another passage from Wendell Berry. I promise this one isn't quite so long. Is work something that we have a right to escape? And can we escape it with impunity? We are probably the first entire people ever to think so. All the ancient wisdom that has come down to us counsels otherwise. It tells us that work is necessary to us, as much a part of our condition as mortality, that good work is our salvation and our joy, that shoddy or dishonest or self-serving work is our curse and our doom. We have tried to escape the sweat and sorrow promised in Genesis, only to find that in order to do so, we must forswear love and excellence, health and joy. So he's warning against a mindset that views work and sweat as undesirable. When we see those things as undesirable, I think we automatically start to make selfish choices. We automatically become self-focused. Toil was a part of the curse, but work was not. And sort of like the difference between dirt and soil, there is a difference between toil and work. They are not the same. Work was part of God's good design from the very beginning. It was built into his intentions for man. And it was designed to flow out of connection, to flow out of love for and a connection with God and creation. The curse broke that connection, and work became a struggle for survival. And I imagine most of the joy went out of it. We, even in a very broken world, we still find immense joy and fulfillment in doing good work. Imagine what that was like before things got broken. So God created the world good. And then that goodness was broken and disrupted. And we as his people are tasked with helping to restore that goodness. Colossians 1, 15 and 16 says, "The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authority. All things have been created through him and for him." That last bit kind of took me by surprise. I don't know that I've ever paid attention to that before. If I read this right, it's saying that the Father created all this for the Son. Was it a gift? How does that work? I don't know. But if you view it that way, if this world was a gift from the Father to the Son, we should care deeply about it. We should care deeply about how our choices impact this world. There's a view that it's all going to burn. And let's see, is it somewhere in James that we get some scriptural basis for that view? I'm not prepared to argue against that. I know that there are other people who argue that no, the new heavens and the new earth, heaven is coming down to earth and the earth will be restored. I'm not prepared to argue either one of those points, but what I do know is that I like the end result for myself better from the second view, that the earth is something good that is to be restored, not something bad that is to be destroyed. This might be a good time to open it up for thoughts on that. Again, I'm not trying to push a particular theological point here. I'm not honestly sure where I come out on that, but I do think it matters, or it impacts the way we think. What are your thoughts, Arlen?
If I'm too simplistic on this, somebody can correct me. I'm not sure we need to figure that out to know how we should act. I think it's as simple as thinking about, you know, whatever the situation. I am needing a place to live for a while, and somebody lets me live in their house. It's not mine to destroy. It's not mine to change irreversibly. It's mine to take care of. It's a stewardship because I'm responsible to the owner for that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how we can have a different, how we can think differently about the earth.
Mm-hmm. Brian.
I'm not sure that a view that this earth will end needs to be incompatible with a call to care for it. An analogy that I think of is our understanding that we need to care for our own bodies. Mm-hmm. And so we know that our bodies will end. there will be new bodies, but they will be different. Mm-hmm. And yet that doesn't absolve us of the responsibility to care for our bodies, mm-hmm. for the honor of the Lord, for our own sakes, and for the sakes of those around us. And so I need to care for my body for my children's sake, so that I live and can care for, and can be here for them. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I know that ultimately my heavenly body and my eternal life is more important than my earthly body. And so if my heavenly calling puts my life at risk, that's okay, because that's where I'm headed. And so that is primary, and yet that doesn't keep me from caring for my earthly body. And I think there's some analogy there for caring for the earth.
Daryl in the back.
A lot of times when you read historians' views on kind of environmental issues and the interaction between religion and environmental views, one of the things they'll point out is, especially during the early modern period, so 1500s to 1700s, something like that, the view that God gave humans dominion over the world kind of pushed them to a spot where they said, the wildness of the earth is a problem, and we need to tame it. And you can still see that kind of language as late as, well, I was reading last winter, I was reading some newspaper accounts of Kansas here when the Russian Mennonites moved in, and there were accounts of newsmen gushing over these Mennonites come to tame the wild prairie. And I think that if that is the view that most people have of Christianity, then it makes complete sense that this is ours, we were given dominion over, we can do as we please, and that's the end of the story. Mm-hmm. I think that's a deeply flawed view of what Christianity should believe or what the Bible teaches about the earth.
Yeah. This idea from that quote from earlier, oh, what's this balance of nature you're talking about? We modern men are controlling nature. Yeah. Good, thank you. Dwight.
Sometimes we can be tempted to think, well, if I'd have 1,000 acres, then it wouldn't matter what I do with it. Wendell Berry, in a little booklet entitled Think Little, says, if you steward well the 1 acre or the 1 lot of land that you have, you are doing more than the lobbyists are pushing for policy changes.
Mm-hmm. Gary.
Maybe you ought to be the one that reads the several verses that I'd like to bring into the discussion here.
Go ahead.
It's 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10 through 13, and I think it can be part of our pondering. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of the God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Mm-hmm. I know you referenced something in one of these epistles.
Yeah, I think that's the passage I was going for. Thank you. Thank you. Paul.
So maybe what we're saying, it's not an either or, but it's an end, both. Because on the one hand, the emphasis is this place is going to burn up, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't take care of it. And I think the warning here is we need to be alert because we don't know when he's coming. But that doesn't take care of our responsibility as stewards of the world. Thank you for sharing that.
Anthony.
I'm kind of interested in how our view of the connection between this world and the one to come might have something, might have an effect on how we think of this. I'm not sure if I'm convinced to treat my environment well simply as an ethic or as a morally good thing to do because I was given it as a steward. When I think of steward, I often think of making the best use of something. And I think that we have spent the last several hundred years becoming really familiar with chemical compositions of the things we have around us in order to use them. And that's a different purpose that's a different thing in my mind from learning their purpose as opposed to their use. And then mediating as priests in a sort of cosmic liturgy with them. That's a different picture to me than simply, oh, well, it'll all go away, but, you know, it's a morally good thing to do to take care of it. I really am also influenced by writers who interpret the resurrection and the new heaven and the earth as being, and you'd probably all agree with me, it's somewhat semantics, but it still has a bearing on how we think about this, as even our new bodies and our new heaven and our new earth not as being better replacements, having no connection to the actions and relationships that we developed. I mean, the scriptures talk about storing up treasures in heaven. So that means that what I do here actually translates into something in the new. So it's not made of completely, it's not made out of nothing, I guess is my suggestion, or I'm asking that. I think there's a real hard connection there between what happens now and what comes after. I'm much more convinced by that than just, it's a good idea, you should.
Very good. Mark.
I've pondered a question for probably a couple of years after I read the book American Harvest by Maria Mockett. And I think one of the headwinds that Christians face, as she asks a few of the harvesters, that as Christians, we want to pick and choose what science does or doesn't do for us. So most farmers embrace GMO crops. But there are parts that we absolutely reject from the science world. And I don't know exactly, I still don't know exactly how do we as Christians, how could we articulate our belief in science, how we reject science? It's a little bit like if you're an originalist in the Constitution or a conformist. Does the Second Amendment guarantee that you can have an AR-15 today? And can you be an originalist and a conformist in the Constitution? It's those questions I just cannot come to any conclusive answer on. But I do think that as Christians, we have to be careful that we don't just intentionally pick and choose as we wish, because I'm not sure the world interprets that very well.
Alvin.
What I'd be interested in knowing is the earth like a lump of clay before it's made into pottery or after it's fired? Like, is this something that the intention is that we take it and make something out of it, or is it something that is made and that we should try to preserve it?
That's a very interesting way to look at that. I like that. Thank you. We are Caleb, and then we're out of time.
I'll take a stab at Alvin's question. So there's a number of principles here, and I'll just say some things that I believe. I believe the earth is created to be self-healing, self-regulating, and given time, ecosystems can heal themselves. However, a man through his decisions about management of natural resources can cause very positive changes or very negative changes. And so I would lean towards the view that God has given man wisdom and creativity and the ability to learn and study and create. I think part of bearing the image of God is that we have gifts to create things. And if we're working in sync with the principles that he's built the natural world to run on, we can make things better. At least mitigate some of the negative effects of the fall. And I can think of no greater honor than to participate with the Creator in healing and regenerating our lands and our soils. And we probably will never learn all there is to about how to wisely do that, but that's the quest of a lifetime.
I will close with two quotes here, one from a politician, one from a theologian. I hated to even name the politician, but I need to give credit. So don't take this as an endorsement. This is Bobby Kennedy Jr. The reason that we protect the environment is because there's a spiritual connection. You know, God talks to human beings through many vectors, through each other, through organized religion, through the great prophets, through the wise people, the great books of those religions, but nowhere with the kind of detail and texture and grace and joy as through creation. And when we destroy nature, we diminish our capacity to sense the divine, to understand who God is and what our own potential is and duties are as human beings. It's not bad for a politician. And then N.T. Wright says, "If we believe that God made a beautiful world, which has been spoiled in so many ways, but which still resonates with his love and power, and if we believe that in Jesus God has done the most beautiful thing imaginable, then we must make sure that as far as we are able, in our churches and our personal lives, and in the wider communities where we have influence, we are working to foster and celebrate art, music, dance, drama, poetry, sculpture, and whatever else we can. If the church is colluding with ugliness, if the church is not recognizing, celebrating, and giving opportunities for the many artistic gifts of many of its members, then we should not be surprised if people find it hard to believe us when we speak of the way Jesus' resurrection has launched a new world in which creation itself is renewed and will be renewed until the earth is filled with the glory of God as the waters cover the sea. That is the goal. Justice and beauty point the way. By the power of the Spirit, our calling is to be resurrection people, looking back to Jesus himself and under his guidance and commission, bringing true signs of renewal into his creation today and every day. And I don't know a better way to end this conversation than that. John, if you have a closing song for us, and then Laverne, would you lead us in a closing prayer after that? Franklin, could you bring the mic up front to Laverne?